Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession. We're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
A total eclipse of the sun. Connecticut repeats as men's basketball champion, and inflation pushes back. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, former trade representative and World Bank President Bob Zoellick on what both parties are getting wrong on U.S. trade policy.
If you add barriers to one type of product or another, people will move.
Ann Finucane of Rubicon Capital on whatever happened to ESG.
I don't think there's an argument about the science. I think most companies are committed, but some of the tools they thought they were going to have been held back a little bit.
And former IBM head Sam Palmisano on the right way to regulate generative AI.
What we want the government to do is regulate the uses of the technology.
But we start with those U.S. inflation numbers coming in higher than expected, something that caught many market participants by surprise, but they did not surprise our special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard.
I was not hugely surprised by the numbers. In an economy that's growing faster than potential, with an unemployment rate that has a three handle, in the presence of massive and growing budget deficits, and epically easy financial conditions, the idea that inflation would remain robust or even accelerate should not be a surprise to anyone. And that's what this data suggests. It was not me or some outside observer who emphasized the concept of supercore inflation, that is taking out the transitory stuff and also taking out housing. This confirms the idea that the neutral rate is way above the 2.6% level that the Fed has been using as a North Star. In my view, puts back on the table. It is still not what I would expect, but you have to take seriously the possibility that the next rate move will be upwards rather than downwards.
As much as Larry Summers may have been warning about inflation staying higher than we'd like, the reaction from the markets did not look like they'd been fully prepared. The S&P 500 was off 1.6% for the week, ending at 5123, much closer to that year-end median number of 5100 set by our Bloomberg elves. The NASDAQ gave up just under 0.5% on the week, while the yield on the 10-year was up 11 basis points to end at 4.5%. To explain all this to us, we welcome back now Kristen Bitterly. She's head of investment solutions for Citigroup Global Markets. Always great to have you, Kristen.
Good to see you.
It's all about inflation, it looks like.
It is all about inflation, and I would also say earnings. So let's just look at the price action that we've seen to start the second quarter. You have geopolitics. You also have earnings season kicking off. You have some seasonal elements to what we see in April. This week, you tend to see a lot of tax payment selling, both within the bond market and the municipal bond market, as well as within the equity market. So when you combine all of this and put into perspective that just yesterday we were at all-time highs in the NASDAQ, and we're coming off two quarters of double-digit gains, I think we may be putting too much weight on some of the volatility that we're seeing that are pretty garden variety pullbacks within the market.
We spent a lot of time worrying about the labor market, especially focusing on those jobs numbers we get every month. Are they really a factor at this point?
So I think if you're going to say what matters more, is it the labor market or is inflation in terms of the Fed's dual mandate and what they're going to pay attention to, the data that we have out of the labor market is very robust. The job creation that we've seen, if we look at it year over year, you could start to see some cracks in that. So for example, you can look at JOLTS and you can see the millions of jobs that we've actually come down in terms of openings. You could also look at the quits rate that's stabilized a bit. So we've seen some softening, but I think the large picture, a pretty robust labor market. That being said, when you look at inflation, that's where the Fed's attention is. And I think what we're seeing right now, and what Larry Summers just mentioned, is the fact that the Fed needs to see a trajectory of disinflation. And so what we have for this first quarter, we don't have that data. We have more of a stalling and a pause. And so to credibly be able to cut and know that inflation is on a path to actually what we believe is going to be 2.5% by this year's end, you need to see some of those trends actually take place.
So, Kristen, you said it's not just inflation data, it's also earnings. What are we looking for earnings?
It is. So within earnings, I think it is something about actually beating and then raising guidance and expectations, because the expectations right now, I think, are relatively reasonable. I think, what are we going to see? We raised our expectations for the full year. So we came into this year relatively conservative, thinking that we would see slower growth data. I think that when you look across the U.S. equity market, it's been really resilient. So you have about 5 sectors out of the 11 that are anticipated to deliver earnings growth. You also have some sectors that have been surprises. So when we look at the price of oil and what that is going to do for energy, even if we look at utilities, the anticipated earnings growth is in the 20s. So from a percentage standpoint, which is oddly actually a beneficiary of AI. So expect more AI language, but in sectors that you wouldn't expect.
What about Main Street versus Wall Street? Because Russell 2000 has not had an easy time of it.
It is not. And if you look at like small business confidence measures, they're also not where we would want them to be. So I think this is another thing when people are talking about whether or not the Fed's going to cut and some of the measures that we're looking at, I think you have to say, why do we see such strong consumer spending? Why do we see the resiliency? And really, it is a delineation between, if you're looking within the market, the corporations that have their balance sheets in order, that took advantage of historically low interest rates. Even at the beginning of this year, we saw a huge amount of investment-grade issuance come to market. It's actually the highest quarter since what we saw back in 2020. So there are a lot of companies that have their balance sheet in order. That's very different than the Russell 2000.
At the very end here, any investment advice? How do you invest in this climate?
So a couple of things. I would say stay diversified. So when you look at the price action today, there is value to having both fixed income within your portfolio as well as equities. The broadening out to make sure that, again, you're not going to unprofitable parts of the market or highly levered, but you're finding opportunities to take advantage of some of these themes, but at a reasonable valuation. The other thing that I will say is if you're worried about geopolitics, there are hedging opportunities that exist. So don't trade your portfolio based on geopolitics or elections, but take advantage of some of those hedges to stay invested.
Yeah, unfortunately, we need some of those hedges on geopolitics, I'm afraid. Many thanks to Kristen Bitterly of Citigroup Global Markets. Artificial intelligence is on the march. Jamie Dimon says it may be as powerful as the invention of the steam engine or the discovery of electricity. And the government has given AI chipmaker TSMC $11.6 billion to build a plant in the United States. But some say that the government is behind on figuring out a safe regulatory framework for this rapidly developing technology. To give us his perspective on regulation in the tech industry, we welcome back now Sam Palmisano. He's former head of IBM and now chairman of the Center for Global Enterprise. Sam, great to have you back on Wall Street Week. As I say, you have a perspective, a historical perspective here. This is not the first time we've had major tech innovation. If you go back to Windows and you look at the smartphone, you look at social media, put this in perspective. What has the government done in the past, and what has it done well and maybe not so well?
Oh, David, thank you. It's great to be back on the program, and it's always good to be with you. So good evening to everyone. You know, as a friend of mine put this, we always dress for yesterday's weather. That's especially true when it comes to regulation, right? Governments tend to apply existing laws and frameworks to new phenomena, which is a challenge. I'll use two examples. I'll do antitrust and then subsidies or tariffs. And I'm going back to the 80s here, but it's funny how history repeats itself. So take the first suit, which is IBM. It was mostly about a mainframe dominance. It lasted from the last day of the Johnson administration to the start of the Reagan administration, and it was finally dismissed. Microsoft, mostly about bundling Windows and browsers, but trying to think about how relevant that would be today in today's world. So the result is that over time, these suits kind of last so long that the technologies advance and they become used. I'll give you another example, tariffs and subsidies, since you brought up the CHIPS Act. It might be relevant here as well. In the 80s, the issue was Japan. It wasn't necessarily what's happening from the concerns with China and their supply chain. But it was in semiconductors and mostly memory. Reagan slapped 100% tariffs on chips from Japan. And a year later, Congress approved $500 million to subsidize American chip companies. Those days, that was a lot of money, needless to say. Both efforts fell flat. So why? Well, one thing, all the incentives were on memory chips, and the industry had moved to microprocessors, now called logic. And so we missed it again. And so my point is, it's really, really hard in tech to pick winners and losers because the space just moves so fast. And that's what we're seeing again today.
If you were to advise the government, as you do regularly on these issues, what's the right balance between, on the one hand, running a risk of it getting out of control, going off on its own? Some people would say that happened with social media, actually, at this point, that we let it go too far too fast, as opposed to, on the other hand, regulating and actually suppressing some of the innovation that we need.
Well, actually, you make a great point. And the analogy of the internet and social media is absolutely true. The first thing, a first comment I would make, it's not just the Biden administration executive order. It's also what the EU is doing, the EU AI Act. I think that's really, really important because you need to have coordination on a global basis because all these companies and all these systems are going to operate on global scale. So that's a positive thing. But from a company's perspective, you need to understand because you got to play offense and defense. So in playing offense, you need to understand where you can apply the technology, how you can make good use of the technology. So what you really want, and if you're a CEO running these companies, you actually want basically guardrail. You want rules to be established. You want regulation. Now, Ken Chenault and I created this thing called the Data Trust Alliance to look at transparency and integrity of the data and in the operations or in the uses of the data. And it's a couple dozen companies and the CEOs are involved. But where they're coming from, which is different from the technology leaders, they're coming from the perspective is that you don't want you to regulate the technology because that will limit innovation. What we want the government to do is regulate the uses of the technology. What are those use cases? And let's look at those use cases, and I'll call it a continuum of risk. So if it's national security, high risk. If it's call centers and those sorts of things, low risk. It's almost as I take it back to the cyber days when Tom Donilon and I were running the Obama Commission for Cyber. We had a continuum of risk. One was no one dies, and the other was photo sharing. So this is how I think if I was the government, or I would suggest to the government, they think about the use cases and how the technology is being applied, not just the technology itself. Because if you influence the usage and you have guardrails established that you get to the standards, because it's going to be hard to have standards day one.
Sam, it's always such a treat to have you on Wall Street Week. Thank you so much. That's Sam Palmisano of the Center for Global Enterprise. Coming up, India heads into 44 days of national elections. We talk with Rushir Sharma of Rockefeller International about the boost Prime Minister Modi is likely to get from the Indian economy.
The fact that inflation has been relatively under control is, I think, one of those underappreciated factors.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. India's economic growth will play a large role in the national elections starting later this month. Growth that has been the goal since Prime Minister Indira Gandhi visited President Reagan back in 1982.
In India, our preoccupation is with building and development. Our problem is not to influence others, but to consolidate our political and economic independence. We believe in freedom with a passion that only those who have been denied it can understand. We believe in equality because many in our country were so long deprived of it. We believe in the worth of the human being, for that is the foundation of our democracy and our work for development.
And Prime Minister Modi emphasized that same economic growth when he visited President Biden 41 years later.
When I first visited the U.S. as a Prime Minister, India was the 10th largest economy in the world. Today, India is the 5th largest economy. India will be the 3rd largest economy soon. We are not only growing bigger, but we are also growing faster.
To explain how much economic progress India has made and what it could mean for the upcoming elections, we welcome back now Rushir Sharma, chairman of Rockefeller International and founder and CIO of Breakout Capital. Rushir, great to have you back with us. We have elections coming up, and the economy, I think, according to your column, actually, the FT, will play a large role in this. Give us your perspective on just how far India has come economically.
Right up until the 1980s, India was a big laggard economy, that its rankings in both per capita income terms, in both its, in terms of its GDP size, kept on falling for that entire period. The turning point, as far as India's economic progress was concerned, I think, was really the 1990s, when you had the major burst of economic reforms that took place, when the Indian economy nearly went bankrupt. It had to go to the IMF again and get a big rescue program. That's really what began India's economic turnaround, and that's what led to India's rise. And what we've seen over the past few years is a continuing momentum of that rise, which began in the early 1990s.
So that began before Prime Minister Modi came to office. At the same time, it has continued. How much is he getting credit today in India for that as he looks toward these elections?
Well, he's getting lots of credit for that. And I think there are two or three reasons for it. One is the fact that it's reached a sort of critical mass, which is that when India was rising in the 1990s or in the 2000s, the base was much smaller. It's still, in per capita income terms, a relatively small base. But now that India has become the world's fifth largest economy, that just tends to have a much greater effect. But in terms of his direct credit, I think that the one thing which is possibly underestimated is that how non-inflationary this growth has been over the last few years. That if you look at the previous growth spurts that India had, particularly in the preceding Congress government, one of the big problems was that it also led to a big surge in inflation. This time, inflation has been relatively low. And that is a big plus, because in politics around the world, economic growth may or may not matter, but inflation matters. Nothing kills the prospects of incumbents as much as rising prices. And the fact that inflation has been relatively under control is, I think, one of those underappreciated factors, because we as economic commentators or even political commentators focus so much on just the headline GDP growth numbers. So the fact that you have very low inflation or relatively low inflation, I think, has been a big positive. The other couple of things which are working in his favor is that this growth spurt has happened at a time when so many other emerging markets, including China, have been sputtering.
You point out in your Financial Times column, he also has managed his own press quite effectively. I mean, you have a quote in there that there's freedom of speech, but it's not freedom from speech, the consequences of that speech. After speech, there's not so much freedom. So how has he managed that? And is there a trade-off there where they actually are giving up some of their civil rights in the interest of growth, which we've seen other places over time?
Yeah, there's no question about that. That if you look at the Indian media, there's a lot of self-censorship which goes on. A lot of news organizations that have spoken out against Modi or the BJP, they have been under investigation. The pattern is quite clear, which is that if you have been speaking out against Modi, you better watch out. I think that's been the clear message that has been sent out. The state machinery has been used quite extensively to silence critics and to silence the media.
One of the things you draw an analogy to is after World War II, Taiwan and also South Korea particularly have had amazing growth with more authoritarian regimes, more than I think we'd say Prime Minister Modi has, but that went away as they really moved into the middle income levels. So that raises the question, at some point, does that deal get changed? If that is the deal Prime Minister Modi has with the people of India, does that get changed at some point as it approaches middle income status?
No, I think that in India's case, it's a bit different, because India is going the other way, that India gave its people political freedom first and did not give its people economic freedom. And so you didn't have much economic progress for the first 40 odd years of the new India, which emerged after British rule. So now it seems to be reversing the order a bit. So more than per capita income levels, I think that there are two things. One, that Modi has to keep delivering on the economic front for this deal to work. And the second thing I'll say is this, that having covered Indian elections for the last 30 odd years, that Indians do believe a lot more in democracy. It runs in the fiber of that country. They seem to, or at least the swing voters seems to have suspended that for now in return for what they perceive as economic progress. But it really seems to be because of Modi, that he has got such personal appeal that he's been able to strike such a bargain with the swing voter. In the post-Modi world, I'm not sure that this works anymore, because India is a very federal country. Even today, nearly half of the states in India, the 28 odd states in India, those are run by opposition parties. So that's quite a high number.
Rushir, it's always such a treat to have you with us. Thank you so much. That's Rushir Sharma, whose new book, What Went Wrong with Capitalism, is out this coming June. Japanese Prime Minister Kishida visited Washington this week in the midst of a difficult dispute over whether Nippon Steel could buy U.S. steel, focusing American voters once again on the role of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. economy. Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee is here to lay out the issues.
The U.S. came out of World War II as the global manufacturing powerhouse. Factory jobs became a ticket to the middle class. That's changed. Factories and the jobs that were done there have disappeared all over America. Blame China, blame globalization. The presidential candidates do, and they're doing a lot of talking about changing things back. The number of factory jobs has been falling for almost 50 years, and for a lot of people, the middle class paycheck has disappeared. Simply slapping tariffs on imported factory goods or subsidizing the construction of new plants in the U.S. might work in some isolated cases, but they can't bring back the past. Manufacturing itself has changed, and it's not going to change back. As a share of GDP, it peaked in 1953 and has been falling ever since. In terms of output, though, industrial production is higher than ever. We're making more stuff, but we're doing it with far fewer workers and much more productive equipment. What we make has also changed. Less steel, more semiconductors. George W. Bush, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden put or kept tariffs on imported steel. The idea was to make imported steel more expensive than domestically produced. What happened? American steel mills just raised their prices. Imports of steel dipped, but are now higher than ever. Wages for technology workers are higher than for those in old line manufacturing, but they're rising even on the assembly line as what we make in America now becomes even more advanced. That's creating a shortage of the skilled workers needed in this new manufacturing world, suggesting perhaps policies based on education for the future will do more than nostalgia for the past. David?
To explain how U.S. trade policy affects the labor market, we welcome now Bob Zelick. He's senior advisor to the Brunswick Group. Ambassador Zelick served as president of the World Bank and is United States trade representative under President George W. Bush. So, Ambassador, thanks so much for being back with us. Appreciate it. We just have had the visit from Prime Minister Kishida of Japan to Washington. Overhanging that was this dispute or possible dispute about the Nippon Steel acquisition of U.S. Steel. Give us your views about that issue and how much of that is really legitimate policy as opposed to, and I don't say it's illegitimate, questions about politics in Pennsylvania.
Well, clearly the politics are dominant, David. And, you know, this is really an example of the first time we've had two presidents that are economically isolationist in their policies back to back. And they're sort of competing to try to figure out how we can add protections. Now, in the case of the steel industry, Trump put on a 25% tariff that Biden kept in place. And so you already, well, as people ask about inflation, well, you know, that gives you a pretty good example of why steel prices were going to go up. But this case is a little different. This case is Nippon Steel, a Japanese company, wanting to come in and buy U.S. steel, frankly, invest more capital, keep the jobs, add technology, add to competition. But the steel workers, who President Biden wants to court, have resisted, along with one other U.S. company that wanted to pay about half as much for U.S. steel and have a monopoly position. So it gives you an example of the politics now that is sort of running the economic and trade policy.
Bob, let me put one more complicating factor on that, is national security. I mean, there was a time, as I understand it, where the steel industry was critical to U.S. national security, and we were very protective of that. I think that time has largely gone by as we've moved, frankly, into semiconductors, which are so much more important in defense. How do you overlay national security concerns to maybe come out in a different place when it comes to trade policy than you otherwise would?
Well, the case that you started with is an excellent example. So we've just had the Japanese prime minister come to town. He's a close ally. They're increasing their defense expenditures. We're trying to deepen the security relationship with Japan to deal with the dangers of China. But we say that the Japanese can't produce steel in the United States. remember, this is steel produced in America. They're not going to move the plants. When, if you're trying to think about security, you want to have a variety of sources, but certainly you want to work with your allied partners and countries. You don't want to tell the Japanese, oh yeah, you're our security partner on military things, but we can't have you invest in America.
Bob, thank you so very much for being a Wall Street. We really appreciate it. That is Ambassador Bob Zelek of the Brunswick Group. Coming up, ESG has gone from all the rage to hardly mentioned in some quarters. We go through what happened and why with Ann Finucane, chair of Rubicon Capital.
The top companies are there.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. ESG, after becoming all the rage, the very term has suffered something of a decline as it became a political rallying cry for some. To bring us up to date on where things stand today, we welcome back now Ann Finucane. She's chair of Rubicon & Capital and former vice chair of Bank of America. Ann, always great to have you on. If you just read the front pages of the newspaper, you'd think ESG is almost dead because some people are sort of running away from it. Where are we right now? Is there a reduction in enthusiasm or commitment?
I think there's some confusion around it. Let's just sort of go back here for a minute. The real genesis of ESG was post-financial crisis and the Great Recession, when there was certainly ample reason for the world to wish that corporations were a little clearer on their value proposition to their shareholders, to their communities, to their employees, to their customers, etc. So ESG is kind of a sort of next generation of corporate responsibility. And everybody had some version of corporate responsibility in their frameworks. So what we're really talking about that changed is the E. And the E is largely a part of, I think, a pretty universal acceptance that climate change is real. The scientific community has been very compelling. Most of global corporations, local corporations, and most governments in the world agree we need to address climate change. Now, how we do it, the pace we do it at, that's become somewhat politicized. And then the other thing is so there's a ESG, how you behave, and then there is the ESG funds. Well, the ESG funds are a whole other thing. The ESG funds mean a fund and how it performs, and it's like any other fund.
That distinction Anne Finucane makes between ESG tied to how a particular company behaves and ESG simply reflecting how a company is affected by climate change, regardless of what it does, is an important one that is often confused, according to Professor Andy King of Boston University.
Most ESG funds are what I call light green funds, which they're using ESG scores to pick stocks and put them in their portfolio. And most of them are not very different from other comparable types of funds. If I think about what a manager might do with ESG funds, that I think is very valuable. And you can be looking at what you're doing in terms of the risks that you face, and you could be making good investments on how to change your firm. At the public assets level, I think the effect is much more minor, and it's very difficult to have a higher return. And as we said, it's very difficult to have any impact with that.
At this point, the problem is not a lack of voluntary commitments on the part of companies trying to address climate change.
The top 10 companies in the U.S., whether you're looking at revenue, market cap, net income, however you want to define it, most of those companies have made commitments to decarbonizing their companies, demonstrating the decarbonization. Most are committed to net zero. Their sort of end dates may be a little different, and their descriptions may be a little different. But the top companies are there. Even the fossil fuel companies, which I know is more controversial, are making commitments. Now, their focus is more on carbon capture and sequestration storage and less about new forms of clean energy. But, you know, I defy you to mention a company that hasn't put something forward in this effort. And, you know, 2023 was the hottest year in history, of recorded history. I don't think there's much argument that we're looking at extreme weather, water shortages, food shortages, a rise in sort of climate-related diseases like asthma. So I don't think there's an argument about the science. I think most companies are committed, but some of the tools they thought they were going to have been held back a little bit. And what I mean by that is everyone talked about blended finance. So that meant that companies and governments and multilateral development banks would work together. So that would mean multilateral development banks would actually have to change considerably. Those changes are slow coming. Companies thought that they would have carbon credits or carbon offsets, and you know I'm focused on that in my own work. Well, those have been slow to come because the NGO community has really resisted them, and really is sort of problematic because there's plenty of proof that it's those companies that are doing the most in just using carbon credits as a delta to close the gap that are making the most progress. So some of the tools companies thought they would have are no longer either not there or they're slow coming.
One of the tools Professor King says could help companies meet their climate commitments would be something adopted by the European Union 2 years ago.
A carbon tax would help. The great thing about things like that is that then the information is carried in the price. And so people are able to make much better decisions. Or carbon tradable permits or something like that would be wonderful as well.
Absent governmental action, such as a carbon tax, he worries that unstructured and unregulated voluntary commitments to limit emissions may mask the need for more fundamental change.
That is a big fear of mine, and we've seen that before in other areas. After the famous Bhopal accident, which killed so many people in India, the chemical industry tried to self-regulate, and it didn't really work. I have to say, as an academic, the research suggesting that ESG is substituting for political activity is not very strong. But it is my experience that says I think that could be happening. I'm looking out the window at the Charles River, and it is clean because of the Clean Water Act that was passed in the 70s, actually under a Republican president. And it's a marvelous thing. I'm breathing better air because we had a carbon tradable permit system for sulfur from coal burning. And that's a marvelous thing. And if we had a carbon tax, people would be moving away from a carbon-intensive kind of fuels and things that they're doing. So all three work well. You got to do one.
So have we made progress? Let's take the E in the environment. Have we seen actual results in terms of carbon emissions coming out of this? Because I've seen conflicting reports about that, exactly how it's worked. Thus far, it's been mainly voluntary, if I'm not mistaken. Have we made progress in the real world?
Yeah, we have made progress. Well, it's voluntary in the U.S. It's not voluntary in Europe. And it is sort of double-sided in China. So let's just go out to in, farthest out. China is making enormous progress in green technologies, batteries, rare minerals, wind, solar, et cetera. I mean, they own the market in terms of solar paneling. But they also, you know, erect coal plants at a pace that is just remarkable as well. So they are a tale of two cities. And their commitment is that they will start to reduce their carbon footprint after 2030. Whereas the rest of the world is really making real progress. The United States has made real progress since 2005, 2007. And by 2030, they hope to be about half of what they were in their early 2000s. And we seem to be on pace for that. This is a journey. We're talking about the end of this century. We're talking about net zero by 2050. Could we miss that by both temperatures, this 1.5 degrees cap? I think so. Could we be post-2050? Maybe.
Okay, Anne, it's a real treat to have you back with us. Thank you so very much. That's Anne Finucane of Rubicon Capital. Think the printing press, the steam engine, electricity, computing, and the internet. That's what J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon compared artificial intelligence to in his shareholder letter this week. And our own Wall Street Week contributor Larry Summers has gone even farther.
This could be the most important general purpose technology since the wheel or fire.
There's no question but that the AI transformation is big and getting bigger and doing it fast as computing power increases geometrically and machines take over some of the thinking for us humans.
It's going to be widely available to hundreds of millions of people.
In fact, we're starting to wonder whether a good number of us may be out of our jobs altogether.
Where is this going to have its immediate impact? It's going to be in the knowledge economy.
We've seen versions of this before as automation over the years has eliminated entire categories of jobs.
We had 450,000 telephone operators in this country in the 1950s. You tell me the last time you talked to a telephone operator. We had close to 2 million people, I assume most of them women, classified as typists. That's not even a job category anymore in the BLS.
I saw it in my law firm back in the late 1970s. When I went to work as a summer associate at Wilmer Cutler and Pickering in the summer of 1976, I was introduced to the wonders of the steno pool. The firm kept a team of typists, and yes, as I recall, they were all women. On duty, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That meant we lawyers could call in and dictate memoranda and draft briefs at any time of day or night to have them magically appear on our desks before we got in the next morning. And then the word processor came along a few years later, and the steno pool simply disappeared. Now, after the pandemic taught us all how to Zoom all the time, the office building that used to hold the steno pool may be disappearing as well, as employers struggle to get their employees back into the office, even for part of the week.
We do believe in flexibility. Mm-hmm. We want people to be able to mix their lives and their work properly.
Steve Cohen has said that the four-day work week, whether from home or from the office, may be next up. But then again, don't be too sure that this will mean less work for us. Those word processors that eliminated our steno pool didn't cut back on the amount of work we lawyers did one bit. To the contrary, it made it possible to do more drafts of those memos with more revisions showing up instantaneously. And instead of dialing into a pool of typists, we did our own typing on computers on our desks and in our homes, in our laps on the road. And don't even get me started on smartphones delivering nonstop emails that people expect us to respond to around the clock, all of which puts that steno pool to shame. But even as technology feels like it lets many of us work harder, word comes out of Germany that there may be relief in sight. No, not for us, but for the machines that were supposed to make our lives easier. It seems that Germany has a hard and fast rule against stores being open on Sundays, dating back 1,700 years when Roman Emperor Constantine the Great first became a Christian and decided everyone should observe that day of rest God took after creating the world. That's according to Genesis. Until now, that's meant that you can't go out and buy pretty much anything on a Sunday in Germany. But 4 years ago, regional supermarket chain Tegut thought it had a way around that ban. It opened some small, fully automated
automated convenience stores staffed by robots. The German union representing service workers took one look at it and cried foul. It took Tegu to court and won in the highest court of the state of Hesse. So much for shopping in Hesse on Sundays. But then again, maybe the service union was getting at something more than giving robots their day of rest. Now that it's won the day off for the next generation of workers, can getting them into the union to agitate for other benefits be far behind? To paraphrase Karl Marx, robots of the world unite.
Murder's a new trick for a robot. Respond.
Do not murder him!
We're going to miss the good old days.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.